Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, January 13th, 2022. Border Patrol agents carry out cold weather rescue in Sierra Blanca by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Sierra Blanca. On the morning of January 5th, Border Patrol agents recovered 25 undocumented migrants, the victims of a presumed human smuggling operation, from a locked trailer with no means of escape and no heat, Customs and Border Protection reported in a press release. "They're a real concern for us," spokesman Greg Davis said of the high incidence of cold weather rescues throughout the Big Bend sector's harsh winters. "There have been significant rescues as of late by our agents where individuals were left in hazardous conditions and required immediate medical attention," said Big Bend Sector Chief Patrol Agent Sean L. McGoffin. "Transnational criminal organizations have no concern for humanity. They continually place lives in danger." The agency has shifted some of its resources in recent years toward rescue and recovery of migrants who are often unprepared for the harsh, mountainous terrain on this side of the border. As the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, Customs and Border Protection rolled out a series of 30 rescue beacons to be located in remote reaches of the Big Bend sector in 2021. The brightly colored beacons have a flashing light to guide migrants at night and a mirror that reflects light during the day. When activated, the beacons alert 911 that assistance is requested. Border Patrol and local emergency services respond when the beacons are activated, but Big Bend Sector Border Patrol recognizes the limitations of local medical care. "Not every agent is also an EMT, but we do try to send EMT-trained agents to respond to these types of events," Davis said. "They triage patients all the time and sometimes make a life-saving call." Davis explained that the agency always puts medical care first before initiating the process by which undocumented migrants are processed for expulsion from the U.S. "Life and limb, that is our main priority," he said. "We will take care of the law enforcement and immigration aspect later." Photo by Mary Cantrell. Nita Ryan, an activist advocating for the preservation of San Solomon Springs, reviews letters she's written over the past 7 years to the Texas Railroad Commission, protesting the establishment of more deep injection wells in Reeves County. "Rise in earthquakes prompts local concern over health of water resources," by Mary Cantrell, M-K-C-A-N-T-R-E-L-L, at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas. A recent increase in earthquake frequency recorded by the United States Geological Survey in Culberson and Reeves counties has some local citizens concerned about whether seismic activity could negatively impact groundwater quality and the flow of San Solomon Springs. The basis of activists' concerns is that an earthquake could lessen or stop spring flow entirely, as well as contaminate fresh potable water if it were to come in contact with fracking-produced wastewater, which is pumped into the ground using a technique called deep well injection. "If these springs disappear, it could possibly be forever," said Nita Ryan, a local activist who fights the establishment of more deep injection wells in Reeves County by filing protest letters with the Texas Railroad Commission, RRC, which regulates the state's oil and gas industry. Deep well injection is known to cause earthquakes due to the depth of the wells and their connectivity to fault lines, according to the USGS. Whether or not an earthquake could impact spring flow depends on the magnitude and location of the event, said Andrew Keyes, spokesperson for the RRC. A 2021 study done in conjunction with the Big Bend Conservation Alliance and the Southwest Research Institute concluded that the origins of to all six springs in the San Solomon Springs system are located west and northwest of San Solomon Springs, an area with frequent seismic activity, according to the USGS's Earthquake Monitoring Program. The world's largest spring-fed pool, Balmoray State Park in Toya Vale, is supplied with water by San Solomon Springs, the largest of several springs in the area, formed by subsurface geologic faults. More than 15 million gallons of fresh water flow from the spring a day. In addition to providing a recreational oasis in the desert, Balmoray attracts thousands of visitors each year. The springs are home to species of endangered fish and help sustain local wildlife. The springs have been used for farming irrigation as early as the 1870s, and an active canal system allows local farmers to grow alfalfa, cotton, and more. The Civilian Conservation Corporation built the pool in the 1930s, and it opened its doors to the public in 1968. The San Solomon Springs are located in the Davis Mountains Range, a historically seismically active area, originally formed by volcanic activity millions of years ago. On December 27, 2021, a magnitude 4.5 earthquake occurred in Martin County, 27 miles northeast of Midland. It was powerful enough to be felt across Texas and New Mexico. While it did not cause major damage, it was one of the strongest recorded in West Texas in the past decade. Just before the significant earthquake, the RRC ordered an indefinite suspension of deep well injection disposal, effective December 31st, for four counties near Midland to Odessa. While the ban did not apply to Culberson or Reeves counties, activists, including Ryan, said the ban was a step in the right direction toward lessening the impacts of fracking in the region. Brewster, Culberson, Hudspeth, and Reeves counties all lie within the oil-rich Permian Basin in a sub-region called the Southern Delaware Basin. According to the RRC, there are a total of 89 deep injection wells, or saltwater disposal wells, in the northern Culberson-Reeves seismic response area. A designation established by the RRC, which allows them to coordinate with the local oil and gas industry to reduce seismic hazard. There has been an increase in seismicity in this response area since 2009, said Dr. Alexandros Savaitis, research scientist with the Bureau of Economic Geology and leader of the TexNet Seismic Observatory and the Center for Integrated Seismicity Research. TexNet operates a number of earthquake monitoring stations in West Texas in Brewster, Culberson, and Reeves counties, including a station installed at Balmoray State Park. Savaitis said he was unaware of any peer review publications studying potential earthquake impacts on San Solomon Springs. From 1931 to 2008, only one earthquake occurred with a magnitude of 4.0 or greater in the area. From December 2020 to the present, there have been 13 earthquakes of 4.0 magnitude or greater, said Savaitis. Six of these 4.0 magnitude or greater earthquakes were experienced in a one-month period from September to October 2021. An unprecedented frequency of significant earthquakes in a localized area of Texas, according to the RRC. The RRC staff's analysis of available information has determined that saltwater disposal well injection is likely contributing to seismic activity in this area, says their website. Ryan, who has been concerned about the seismic activity for years, has been a Toyovale resident since 1984. She co-owns Funky Little Dive Shop and Toyovale Desert Oasis with her husband, Daryl, who served as the superintendent of Balmoray State Park for a number of years. They live on 400 acres adjacent to the park. Ryan jokes she's so close she can throw a rock in the pool from her front yard. Both of Ryan's businesses are located across the road from the pool and have been economically affected by the park's closures in the past. A 1996 earthquake originating in Marathon, the first in West Texas in 64 years, had a 5.6 magnitude and damaged their buildings. The pool was closed because it turned murky white, she said. I'm just an individual who's experiencing the harm that all this is causing and trying to protect our livelihood, said Ryan. Her close ties to the park, where all three of her kids learned to swim in the pool, led her to begin seriously protesting fracking wastewater disposal wells in 2016, out of a desire to preserve the precious natural resource. Ryan reviews pending disposal well permits, which are published in her local paper, the Pecos Enterprise, and files protest letters to the RRC when she believes a proposed well is too close to San Solomon Springs. She has been met with a lot of pushback from the RRC and attorneys of oil and gas companies, she said. When I first started protesting this, I'm labeled a troublemaker, tree hugger, water protector. Don't we all need to be tree huggers and water protectors? I mean, we can't exist without water, said Ryan. Ryan has driven to Austin to attend RRC preliminary hearings on proposed disposal wells, but said the legal regulatory environment is intimidating, and she has continually been dismissed as not an affected person, which effectively tosses out her protest. The RRC defines an affected person as a person who has suffered or will suffer actual injury or economic damage other than as a member of the general public or a competitor. Affected persons may also include adjacent property owners, county and city clerks. In a 2019 letter addressed to the RRC, protesting the establishment of a disposal well by High Roller Wells, LLC, Ryan wrote about the pool's 2018 structural failure, arguing the damage could be a result of cumulative structural damage caused by low-level quakes, despite Texas Parks and Wildlife's insistence that was not the case. TPWD later announced, after months of geotechnical evaluation, the damage was caused by decades of erosion from spring flow. Ryan and Gibson said they have been successful half a dozen times in protesting potential disposal wells, but most of the time permits are granted. Once, when Ryan recruited friends in Saragossa and launched a grassroots effort to gather 300 letters protesting a disposal well, the application for the well was withdrawn. But for the most part, said Ryan, she hasn't had much luck mobilizing her community. A lot of people are concerned, but they won't voice their concerns, said Ryan. You have to stop and think in these small communities, these oil companies bring in jobs. You don't want to jeopardize who's putting food on your table. Coyne Gibson, an independent researcher in the area with a background in the oil and gas industry, has been monitoring deep injection wells for the past 7 years and attending Railroad Commission meetings with other concerned citizen scientists. Gibson monitors seismic activity using USGS data, reviews permits being issued from the Texas Railroad Commission, and files protests whenever he feels a well is proposed in an area where it may cause environmental harm, like Ryan. He said he has directly witnessed increased seismic activity in the region as a result of fracking and fracking-related operations. If earthquakes were to continue on their current trend, it could result in significant impacts for area springs, he said. As these seismic events occur, particularly as they get larger in magnitude, the risk of disrupting the deep fracture systems that feed aquifer water to the spring systems can be impacted, said Gibson. The most extreme case would be that an event occurred with sufficient energy to disrupt spring flow to San Solomon Springs. Without the draw of Balmoray State Park, area businesses would likely be negatively affected, causing ripple effects in the local economy. If something were to happen such that San Solomon Springs stopped flowing, you have the loss of that oasis and then the corresponding cascade of economic impact, said Gibson. There are also concerns of potential water contamination and structural damage, said Gibson. You can feel these earthquakes as far south as into the Davis Mountains, said Gibson. It's not necessarily that there's a huge earthquake and something falls down. It can be the case that over a sufficient period of time, through a series of small magnitude events, it creates cumulative damage in the structure. Saltwater disposal wells are run by a range of operators, from independent contractors to publicly traded companies. Landowners can even repurpose a well on their property and turn it into a saltwater disposal well by buying up cheap, used equipment and going through a simple permitting process, said Gibson. There are a number of brokers that put independent contractors in touch with operators looking for disposal sites. Gibson is advocating for better oversight and tighter regulatory processes with respect to permitting and monitoring of fracking operations and deep injection wells, he said. In October 2021, the RRC announced it would work with oil and gas companies to reduce the frequency of earthquakes in the northern Culberson Reefs seismic response area and come up with a seismic response action plan. The plan, they said, would result in no more 3.5 magnitude or greater earthquakes within 18 months of implementation. The RRC said its staff would review earthquake frequency, magnitude, and disposal volume in the area. An industry group is currently developing an operator-led response plan. The RRC hopes to have an agreed plan of action in place soon, said Andrew Keyes, spokesperson with the Railroad Commission of Texas. Because injected fluid is sometimes hydraulically connected to faults, causing induced earthquakes, the many faults in the northern Culberson Reefs seismic response area and surrounding areas could affect the flow of San Solomon Springs if they were to shift. Dr. Savadas said, based on the current seismicity, the primary area of concern is the Grisham Fault Zone, which runs through Reeves County. The significant length of the fault can equate to a high-magnitude earthquake if the fault slips all at once versus in smaller parts. Using a sophisticated network of fault maps, the USGS is able to model potential outcomes of seismic events in order to help communities plan for emergencies. In an earthquake scenario mapped by the USGS, the West Lobo Fault, located in Jeff Davis County, is the epicenter of a theoretical 7.2 magnitude quake, with a high probability for structural damage in the county and surrounding areas. County lines are arbitrary compared to the large-scale forces like a region's geology and hydrology, said Gibson. And while the Delaware Basin is rich in hydrocarbon shales, the processes used to extract hydrocarbons is water-intensive and competes for water resources with populations using it for agriculture, he said. On average, for every one barrel of crude oil extracted, about 7 to 10 barrels, or 280 to 400 gallons, of wastewater are produced, according to the U.S. Department of the Interior Bureau of Reclamation. That's a pretty insidious loop, especially in a landscape that is a transitional desert, said Gibson. Federal judge rules against a Gage hotel owner in lawsuit over early pandemic closure. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Brewster County. A federal judge has ruled in favor of Brewster County Judge Eleazar Cano in a lengthy legal battle between the local official and Gage hotel owner, J.P. Bryan, who claimed Cano's early pandemic decision to shutter hotels violated his constitutional rights. In the December 15th ruling, U.S. District Judge David Counts declared that Cano had a rational basis for ordering the closure of hotels and short-term rentals in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and was within his right to do so, rejecting Bryan's claims that Cano's actions were unjustified and unconstitutional. While there is more than one reasonable way to respond to the COVID-19 outbreak, Judge Cano's orders and declarations have at least a real and substantial relation to protecting public health, said the ruling. Bryan, a Houston businessman and preservationist who operates the Marathon establishment, first sued a number of Brewster County officials, including Cano, in March 2020, claiming county leaders had not identified an emergency or urgent public necessity that justified the shuttering of hotels. Bryan soon withdrew that lawsuit, but filed a new one solely targeting Cano in April of that year. The suit argued Cano's actions violated the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution because the shutdown amounted to the unreasonable seizure of property, and the 14th Amendment, or Equal Protection Clause, because other businesses were allowed to continue operating. Bryan and his attorneys also claimed Cano did not have adequate cause to shut down hotels because at the time of the closures, there were no reported cases of COVID-19 in the Tri-County region. Cano testified that at the time he was in communication with the local coronavirus management team and given what was known about the spread of the virus, the area's tourist-friendly economy, and limited medical resources in the region acted to mitigate the effects of the virus in the area. Cano did not respond to requests for comment for this story. In addition to rejecting Bryan's claims that his rights were violated by Cano, Counts dismissed the hotelier's claim that he was owed monetary damages to compensate him for business loss during the month-long closure. While Bryan claims the shutdown resulted in a revenue loss of $438,202, a figure Cano's lawyers have disputed, according to court documents, Counts concluded Cano could not be sued for monetary damages because he is protected in his role as a state official and was simply acting on behalf of the state to protect citizens of the county from the virus. Plaintiffs ignore the likelihood that the restrictions that were put in place postponed any outbreak in Brewster County, or at least flattened the curve by reducing the number of deaths in the short term to avoid overwhelming the hospital system, said the ruling. Plaintiffs also ignored that the outbreak originated in China and spread quickly across the world, primarily through travel-related cases. Kano's original disaster proclamation, issued in March of 2020, required the closure of all county hotels and short-term rentals. A few days later, he issued an amended order allowing hotel stays for emergency workers, military personnel, and law enforcement, or those using rentals as long-term residences. The order ended in early May, when Governor Greg Abbott allowed a statewide mandate to expire and declared the move to reopen would supersede local orders. Other area county judges issued shelter-in-place orders and limitations on non-essential businesses similar to Abbott's statewide mandates, including Kano, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara, and Jeff Davis County Judge Kareth Hurley. Only Brewster and Presidio counties ordered the suspension of hotel and short-term rental operations. Brian and his attorneys, who did not respond to requests for comment for this story, are within the appeal window for the case, which extends 30 days after the judge issued his final ruling. If Brian decides to appeal the judge's decision, the case will be brought before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Other businesses and entrepreneurs around the country are seeking to recuperate revenue losses brought by the coronavirus pandemic. Some, including Terry Black's Barbecue with locations in Austin and Dallas, have sued their liability insurance providers for monetary damages, but have met with little success. 17 Marfa ISD students and staff test positive. School closed through Monday. By Allegra Hobbs. Allegra at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Marfa Independent School District has temporarily closed its campus due to a rise in COVID infections among students and staff. Classes are expected to resume Tuesday of next week. All classes at both the elementary school and the junior-senior high school are canceled Thursday, January 11th through Monday, January 17th, according to Marfa junior-senior high school principal Allison Ryan Scott. We are looking out for the safety of our students and staff, and this is one way we can do that, said Marfa ISD Superintendent Oscar Aguero. As of press time, 13 students and 4 staff members across the campus had tested positive for the virus, said Scott. The outbreak has left the school district without enough teachers to keep classes open. Most of the students who tested positive have not been on campus since winter break, per Aguero, leading him to believe a 5-day hiatus will be sufficient. COVID testing will be available to students and staff on Monday from 9 a.m. to noon at the elementary school. The school is encouraging students to wear masks and limit social gatherings. Marfa ISD is unable to implement a mask mandate for students and staff due to an executive order from Governor Greg Abbott. In August of last year, the Marfa ISD board decided the superintendent would have the authority to require masks in the event of a school closure due to COVID. But Abbott's order, though temporarily barred by a federal judge, is back in place as of November following a federal appeals court ruling. COVID cases have been spiking in the Tri-County region, according to local doctors, though dwindling testing supplies have left clinics and pharmacies struggling to keep up with the surge. Though doctors have been unable to verify which variant of the virus their patients test positive for, the Omicron variant is currently spreading rapidly throughout the United States. Dr. Christy Alexander of the Marfa Country Clinic told the Big Bend Sentinel last week that she has seen trademark Omicron symptoms in her recent patients. Omicron symptoms include sneezing, coughing, runny nose, and fatigue.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, January 13th, 2022. Horton returns as assistant superintendent by Nathan Heuer. When the opportunity presented itself, Adrienne Horton knew it was the perfect time to take a position she had long strived for in her career. The current Crane High School principal, who was previously a teacher, counselor, and principal within the Fort Stockton Independent School District from 2004 to 2020, will return to her longtime home as the assistant superintendent of curriculum beginning on January 24th. Horton made it official on January 5th after signing her contract in front of the Alamo Elementary staff, the campus she was once principal at for 8 years and will now be based out of. "I feel like a door was opened and I have to go through it," Horton said. "Really, my whole goal had been to be an assistant superintendent, and the opportunity just opened up suddenly. I would honestly tell you I never saw myself going back that way again, but I am excited that it happened." Horton was the definition of the ideal candidate for the position, according to FSISD Superintendent Dr. Gabriel Zamora. The superintendent explained that Horton will play a vital role in helping the district reach its maximum potential academically. "I think the fact that she's been there and done that, and a proven commodity who has now even expanded her abilities more by going somewhere else. She's going to bring what she knows now to our district is incredible." Horton will become the district's third assistant superintendent, along with Gilray Madrid, a fellow principal during her previous tenure, and Ron Klein. With Horton's addition, Zamora emphasized how leadership is critical to the district's success and how Horton will significantly help the district in that manner. "I don't think people understand just how important having a fantastic leader is. You have a fantastic leader to lead a campus, that's all the difference in the world," he said. "A fantastic leader is touching everyone in a positive manner." Horton will not only be in charge of the entire district's curriculum and vertically align all campuses, she'll also be an administrator that oversees Alamo Elementary. The familiarity with the campus and staff will make it a seamless transition for the Woodlands native. "I know the systems. It's the perfect scenario to get into this position. I want to establish the morale that Alamo always had, which was very positive for students, parents, and staff. Help them to align their academics so students and teachers are successful." Zamora added to that notion, stating her familiarity with the Alamo campus will translate to an immediate impact. "She knows exactly what needs to happen on campuses, but specifically that one. That's the advantage. She already knows Alamo campus. She knows a lot of those staff members, and they know her." The addition of Horton is a part of an overhaul to the administrative structure at Fort Stockton ISD. After Zamora's arrival last summer, there were curriculum directors added at each campus and two assistant superintendents added in the past 6 months in Horton and Klein. Zamora said that despite the additions, the district has maintained its good financial standing due to attrition that happened between now and his arrival. "The truth is that we're down from the number of administrators that the district has had in the past. With her, we're balanced, but you know ESSR, three monies in there, and there are five positions being funded with those monies for the rest of this year and two more. We're ahead of schedule in being able to sustain what we're doing. In other words, if they took away the ESSR three monies right now, we wouldn't be out of line." PCMH raises approved by the county, by Megan Waring. Some staff at Pecos County Memorial Hospital can look forward to seeing a little extra in their paycheck this year. On December 21st, the PCMH board approved a competitive wage adjustment for incoming and current employees. Finalizing the agreement, the Pecos County Commissioner's Court approved the hospital's recommendations at its regular meeting on January 10th. Hospitals across the nation have been struggling for the past 2 years with the COVID pandemic, especially with maintaining essential staff. And PCMH is no exception. Giving raises this time around is more of a targeted approach, CEO Betsy Briscoe explained, for those hard-to-fill positions. What we're doing with the competitive wage adjustment is targeting those areas right that we have that we are having the hardest time filling. That's why it's not everybody right now. She added that the hospital's eventual goal is to get staff members in every department to at least $15 an hour in base pay. Under the competitive wage adjustment, registered nurses, hospice will see a base pay increase from $24 to $27. RNs in OR and OB will now get $30 an hour, and ER nurses will see a jump from $35 to $38 an hour. Licensed vocational nurses will get $21.50 an hour, certified nurses' aides $14 an hour, and phlebotomists $14 an hour. Housekeeping and dietary positions will receive $12 an hour. The increase in pay will cost the hospital $654,000 annually. Right now, the way things sit as far as payroll, we can pay this out of our budget. So what we had budgeted for 2022, the COVID adjustments that we did at the end of last year, we received just a little over $500,000 in provided relief funds. PCMH is continuing to look at the budget to see what it can do for positions that were not included. If there are any further adjustments made by the Board of Managers, they would have to go back to Commissioner's Court for final approval. FCST to host storytelling workshop. Fort Stockton Community Theater reminds adults in the community and surrounding area of the upcoming storytelling workshop for adults on Saturday, January 22nd from 9 to 4 p.m. at the Nelson Street Theater. The workshop will be led by renowned storyteller, writer, and gospel singer Sue Roseberry from the Midland Storytelling Festival. The cost of the workshop is $20, which will include lunch. At least 20 people must be registered by 5 p.m. on Saturday, January 15th. Register today for a fun day of learning to tell your story with ease and confidence. Call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180 for more information. Substandard property identified as historic Butts Home by Jeremy Gonzalez. The City of Fort Stockton Substandard Building Committee met for its regular meeting on January 6th. The mission of the committee is to promote the welfare of citizens by securing, repairing, or demolishing structures that are deemed unfit for habitation or hazardous to the public. During their property hearings, the committee revisited a large Victorian-style house that has gradually been deteriorating over the years. While the landscaping has periodically been maintained, the wraparound porch is sagging and is on the brink of a major collapse. The property is currently under the ownership of the Dixon Family Trust, which the committee has had no luck making a point of contact. The City of Fort Stockton Code Enforcement reported they have had successful response to the city issued letters requesting landscape compliance, but no word back on attending the Substandard Building Committee meetings. The structure has had glowing reviews from the committee, with a consensus of it being a historic framework dating back to the early 1900s. The committee unanimously voted to have the property handed over to the Historic Landmark Commission, which recently merged with the Keep Historic Fort Stockton Beautiful Board. The action saved the property from demolition, which was then uncovered to have more historic significance than the committee assumed. Following the meeting, it was discovered by the Annie Rigg staff and the Fort Stockton Historical Society through the Pecos County History Book to be the old Herman Butts house. Butts helped settle his Uncle Herman Kohler's estate on the frontier of Fort Stockton in 1894. Butts wore many hats in town, including a 26-year county treasurer, county judge, donor of land for the Butts Elementary School, brother-in-law of James Rooney, investor of the company that started the Fort Stockton Pioneer, and his last business venture, the Fort Stockton Insurance Agency. Alongside Rooney, Butts had a hand in building the Kohler Hotel, which later was owned by Annie Riggs and stands today as the Annie Riggs Memorial Museum. Per the Pecos County History Books, 1508 West Division Street has been unveiled to be the Butts family home, built in 1905. Butts' only daughter, Mary Ann Butts, married J.B. Dixon, which explains the Dixon family trust ownership. In 1970, Dixon opened a yarn shop in her home, with which old bundles of yarn have been seen by code enforcement at the property in its current condition. The wise discernment of the substandard building committee has taken the property off the chopping block and into the hands of the Keep Historic Fort Stockton Beautiful Board, a group that now oversees all historic landmarks.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan Snooze for Thursday, January 6, 2022. Trustees approve redistricting plan. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Meeting in special session on Monday night, the trustees of the Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD approved an order adopting a redistricting plan for school board districts. The action was required in order to obtain population balance as the result of the 2020 census. A public hearing took place prior to the action, but there was no public comment or attendees. According to state and federal statutes, the highest percentage of population in each district away from perfect balance from the highest to the lowest cannot exceed 10%. Based on the 2020 census, that differential was over a 48.5% change from the 2010 census. The approved redistricting would have a maximum deviation of less than 6%. The ideal distribution would have the exact same number of people in each district. Total population within the district was stated as 10,836, which would be an ideal population of 1,548 in each district. MWP ISD had hired the law firm of Allison, Bass, and McGee, a firm that specializes in the redistricting process, to study the redistricting requirements. Attorney Stan Reed of the law firm reviewed the data via teleconference that was presented at the December 13, 2021 meeting. Another special meeting will be required before the redistricting process can be completed. The approved action in Monday's meeting stated, "Order adopting redistricting plan for school board districts." The next meeting will be to take action on order adopting election district plan for school board districts, even though there will be no difference on district boundaries, but will be required to make the action comply with state and federal statutes. The maps of school district boundaries are available at the School Administration Building, 606 South Betty Avenue. Current maps are available, but new maps that show the redistricting boundaries will not be available until after the process is finalized. New voter registration cards will be mailed out after final actions have been taken, Ward County Tax Assessor Vicki Heflin said. Heflin was also present at the meeting. Trustees present for the meeting were Bobby Almanza, Donna Garcia, Joel Greiner, Nancy Epchurch, and Steve Fine. Trustees Quint Melius and Raymond Reyes were not present. In other actions, the trustees approved an action to purchase attendance credits, which is the method the district will use to submit tax recapture payments to the state. The action is required since MWP ISD is considered a wealthy school district. The recapture payments make up the difference in the amount that the state has determined is necessary in order to educate each child and the amount the district has received. Because MWP ISD has raised an amount significantly greater per child than what the state says is necessary, the district will have to return monies back to the state as part of the Wealth Equalization Program, or recapture. In personnel actions, Tysha Gardner was hired as an ELAR teacher at Monahans High School. She will replace Danielle Lee, whose resignation was accepted by the trustees. Garner will begin work immediately. Stock show slated for January 24th through 28th. Pee-wee shows and barn tours back this year. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Ward County Stock Show is right around the corner, and plans are well underway for the 83rd annual event. First off, students must remember to keep up their grades in school. If they are not passing at stock show time, they will not be allowed to participate then or at any of the major stock shows, Ward County Extension Agent Haley Lacaz said. Ward County 4-H Adult Leaders Association scholarships to be awarded include the James King Memorial Book Scholarship, the Dora Winkler Memorial Book Scholarship, and the Levine McCurdy Memorial Book Scholarship. The Jess Anthony Memorial Scholarship will also be presented. The Ranch Breakfast, sponsored by the 4-H Adult Leaders, will be served from 6 to 8:30 a.m. on Friday, January 21st, at the Ward County Coliseum. Tickets are $12, cash only, and to-go plates will be available. The menu will consist of steak fingers, eggs, biscuits and gravy, coffee, milk, and juice. The Pee-wee shows and barn tours will be held this year after they were both canceled last year due to concerns over the coronavirus pandemic. On Monday, arrival and weigh-in for rabbits and broilers will begin at 3 p.m., and arrival and weigh-in for swine, goats, lambs will be at 5 p.m. The Pee-wee Rabbit Show will begin at 6 p.m., followed by the broiler and rabbit shows. Judge for the broiler show will be Paul Booth of Lubbock, and Teresa DeSotel of Sudan will judge the rabbit show. Tuesday's events will be the Pee-wee Market Swine Show at 5:30 p.m., followed by the Market Swine Show with Judge Cody Trimble of Garden City. Wednesday at 5 p.m. is the weigh-in for the steers and heifers, followed by the Pee-wee Goat Show at 5:30 p.m., and the Goat Show, which is judged by Chad Coburn of Sterling City. The conclusion of the showing will be on Thursday with the Pee-wee Lamb Show at 5:30 p.m., Market Lamb Show, and Heifer and Steer Show, all judged by Audrey Zeller of San Angelo. Sale pictures for the livestock show sale gets underway on Friday, January 28th, beginning at 8 a.m. The annual barbecue lunch will begin at 11 a.m. with a menu of brisket, sausage, potato salad, beans, cobbler, and tea. Awards presentations will start at noon. The auction of top 4-H animals will kick off at 1 p.m. with auctioneer Leslie Clemmer of Grand Falls. More details will follow in subsequent editions of the Monahans News. Two Monahans High School athletes named to Paralympics High School All-Americans. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. U.S. Paralympics track and field announced last week the 47 men and women who earned spots on the 2021 High School All-American list, and on the list were two Monahans High School athletes, Zach Carter and Hope Santiago. The list recognizes the top high school track and field athletes who have a Paralympic-eligible impairment based on their performances in the 2021 season. Carter, age 17, and his junior at Monahans High School, was born with spina bifida, and Santiago, age 18, and a senior at Monahans High School, was born with caudal regression syndrome. Both were selected for the honor on their performance in the 100-meter dash. Additionally, Santiago was selected for her performance in the shot put. Carter was also named the 2021 Sports and Spokes Junior Athlete of the Year this past summer. Quote, "I am extremely honored to be named as an All-American athlete by U.S. Paralympic Track and Field. With COVID cancellations the year before, two surgeries within 2 years, and a shoulder injury, I wasn't sure how last season would go. But Coach Galindo kept pushing me to be the best, fastest that I could possibly be. I ended up setting a new personal record at shot put in the area track meet, in powerlifting at Texas Regional Games, and in both my races at the state track meet," Carter said. Santiago recently signed a national letter of intent with the University of Arizona to continue her athletic career in adaptive sports with the track and road racing team. and eventually plans on trying out for the 2024 Paralympics. Quote, I'm proud to be named All-American for the second year, 2019 for the 1500 and 2021 for the 100 and shot put, Santiago said. Carter and Santiago are both coached by Monahan's track and field coaches and Paralympics coach Saul Mendoza. Santiago is the daughter of Stella and Angel Santiago, and Carter's parents are Josh and Kelly Carter. Single-family housing repair loans and grants available. With winter and cold weather upon us, the Rural Development of the U.S. Department of Agriculture is reminding residents of rural communities of the 502 and 504 housing repair programs. The Section 504 Home Repair Program provides loans to very low-income homeowners to repair, improve, or modernize their homes, or provides grants to elderly, very low-income homeowners to remove health and safety hazards. To qualify for a loan, the applicant must be the homeowner and occupy the house, have a family income within the very low income limit. For grants, be age 62 or older and not be able to repay a repair loan. Quote, we are currently processing a fair number of applications for this program. However, there is no backlog and there are plenty of funds, Fort Stockton Area Director of the Rural Development USDA, John E. Perkins said. Applications are available year-round as long as funding is available and are processed in the order they are received. Approval times depend on funding availability in the area. Effective December 1, 2021, the current interest rate for single-family housing direct home loans is 2.5% for low-income and very low-income borrowers. Fixed interest rate based on current market rates at loan approval or loan closing, whichever is lower, interest rate when modified by payment assistance can be as low as 1%. There is up to 33-year payback period, 38-year payback period for very low-income applicants who can't afford the 33-year loan term. Grants have a lifetime limit of $10,000 and must be repaid if the property is sold in less than 3 years. Applicants may be offered a loan and grant combination if applicants can repay part but not all of the costs. Quote, generally, rural areas with a population less than 35,000 are eligible. Applicants may check the address of their home to determine eligibility online, Perkins added. Maximum loan amount received is $40,000 and maximum grant amount is $10,000. Loans and grants can be combined for up to $50,000 in assistance. Find additional forms, resources, and program information at www.rd.usda.gov. More information and applications are available from Yolanda Arredondo at 432-360-1300, Consuelo Miller at area code 915-261-1444, or Mary Stefanik at area code 915-261-1446. Landgraf draws challenger for state representative. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Incumbent State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican from District 81 of Odessa, has drawn a challenger in his bid for re-election. Republican Casey Gray, also of Odessa, has launched his campaign to challenge Landgraf. Landgraf said in his bid for re-election, said, quote, I love West Texas and remain unwaveringly committed to our time-honored principles of liberty, self-reliance, and integrity. I'm in the best position to do the most good for West Texas and fight for our conservative values in the Texas House of Representatives. Together, we've made the voice of West Texas as strong as it has ever been in the Texas Capitol, and we're not done yet. It is with a humble heart full of gratitude that I once again ask for your vote. I am honored to serve the community where I was raised, where I met my wife, and where we have chosen to raise our daughter. That's why I will never stop fighting for the Permian Basin. This is my home. With your vote and prayerful support, I'll continue to be a voice West Texans deserve to have in the Texas House of Representatives, Landgraf concluded. In announcing his candidacy, Gray said, quote, "Our nation is at a critical point in our history," Gray is quoted in the press release, adding further, quote, "Never has the radical socialist agenda threatened so many of our American ideals of freedom and liberty. At times like this, the nation looks to Texas to lead, and our leaders must demonstrate courageous servant leadership," end quote. Gray identifies as a Christian conservative Republican and says, in addition to protecting constitutional rights like the Second Amendment, he is pro-life and wants to protect the energy industry and bring additional infrastructure funding to West Texas. Locally, Joel Greiner is challenging incumbent Larry Hanna for Ward County Commissioner Precinct 2. He is also up for re-election for Monahan's Wicked Piute ISD Trustee District 4. Since he cannot hold two elected positions, he said in a statement to the news, quote, "I will file for re-election for school trustee. If successful in my bid for county commissioner, I would continue as trustee for School District 4, if re-elected, until the end of the year and resign at that time," end quote. Hanna said, quote, "I am thankful for the Precinct 2 citizens and ask for their continued support in serving the county. We have a bright future ahead of us," end quote. Filing dates for the school trustee candidates is January 19th through February 18th. The last date to register to vote for the March.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.